It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, we'll hear about large cow farms and water quality in northeastern Wisconsin. First, the University of Wisconsin System Board of Regents met today in Madison. One of the topics on the agenda, the big one, the cut to the UW system in the state budget and how it affects the different campuses. Earlier this morning, the state assembly passed that budget, passed the Senate earlier this week, now headed for Governor Walker's signature. On Monday, the Regents had announced their proposed allocation of the budget cuts. UW-Milwaukee is taking a significant hit, by one measure, the largest drop in annual operating budget. Here to talk about the budget cuts is Mike Sportello. He's the student body president at UW-Milwaukee. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what was your initial reaction when you heard UW-Milwaukee was going to be taking some big cuts when all is said and done?
Sure. I guess what I have to say firstly is that although everybody's hurting here, UW-Milwaukee is in a very unique position. Although we are viewed as one of the biggest campuses, we're also one of the leanest. In 2010, the Goldwater Institute did a report, and it was shown that we're by far one of the leanest universities. We average around 10 or 11th or 12th through a few different categories that had to do with administrative personnel to student ratio and spending to student ratio. And we were shown to be about 10 or 12 out of about 200 universities in terms of leanness. And so when you say that, although UW-Milwaukee has a lot of students, they have room in their budget to cut, they have fat to trim, this really isn't the case. UW-Milwaukee is incredibly lean.
So given that all campuses are facing some cuts because of that leanness, do you think UW-Milwaukee should take proportionally a smaller amount of the state cuts here?
I do. Another problem that UW-Milwaukee faces, because we're so lean, but we also have significantly fewer sources of revenue. Most of our students come from in-state, so we don't have a lot of out-of-state tuition, which gives us a little bit more money. We don't have any things like law schools or medical schools. We don't have a largely significant donor pool right now. And so when you look at the other sources of revenue that perhaps some other colleges and universities have in the system, we really don't have those. And UW-Milwaukee is struggling to meet both of our missions, which is a research university, excellent research, and also an access university to help support students that otherwise would never be able to make it to higher education.
Now, you've been watching this story closely. You were at the Regents meeting today. Have you heard this argument being made to the Regents, apart from yourself?
Sure. Oh, yeah. You know, UW-Milwaukee faculty, staff, administration, and students have all been doing our part to help advocate. We're thankful that a couple other temporary measures, so a $20 million temporary, we received a large portion of that from UW system to help tide over the first year, as well as a good portion of the $50 million that was replaced back into the system by the JFC May 29th Omnibus Amendment that was passed, like you said, the last couple of days by the state and assembly. So we've been doing our part advocating. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough this year, but I'm confident that because all the Board of Regents did this year was approve it for 1 year, we can really strive to change the funding allocation system that they currently use for the next year. I think it'll become quite clear after these cuts go through exactly how much UW-Milwaukee is going to struggle.
Now, tuition is on hold because of the plan and what we've heard from the governor and the legislature. In the future, though, tuition increases will probably be an option to some extent for most campuses. Is raising tuition an option for the future? How much do you think UW-Milwaukee could stand to increase tuition to make up some of these cuts?
Sure. So when you talk about tuition raises, so we've had a tuition freeze for a couple years already, and by the passing of this, if Governor Walker does sign it, which it looks like he's going to, it'll look like there'll be another freeze for 2 years. So even if you just look at, just cost to continue and inflation and things of that sort, it's looking like the system in general may go up a tiny bit in terms of how much UW-Milwaukee is looking to increase tuition beyond that. I'm not sure, and I can't speak to that.
Talking to Mike Sportello, he's the student body president at UW-Milwaukee, looking at the impact of state budget cuts, how they're going to filter down to campuses. Regents have been meeting this week. They've put together their plan. Now, Mike, a lot of campuses have been talking about buyouts, layoffs, that sort of thing. I know UW-Milwaukee now has the real information to move ahead, so there are a lot of decisions still to make. But what are your worries about how these cuts are going to impact students at UW-Milwaukee?
Yeah, absolutely. The impacts are going to be real. You know, it's unfortunate that we don't have a legislature, on both sides of the aisle that doesn't further support increasing, you know, the way we support education. There'll be some real impact at UW-Milwaukee. We've made recommendations to the chancellor. We have a committee that is composed of students, faculty, staff, and administration all together, helping make these big decisions. So we're happy to have a voice at the table, but the way things will be impacted will be all the way from student affairs all the way to academic affairs. And at the end of the day, we're going to deliver a top-notch product because that's what UW-Milwaukee does, but it will be perhaps less rigorous than it has been in the past. And we're looking at some new budgetary models to help fix that, to prepare for the future, but in the short term, we'll definitely take a little bit of a drop there.
Now, you mentioned that UW-Milwaukee currently doesn't have that fundraising pool that a school like UW-Madison might. Do you think there's still room to grow in that regard to do more fundraising for UW-Milwaukee to help cover some of the gap?
Absolutely. So although we don't have the basis, you know, schools like Madison may have, we're actively working towards that. It's obviously been a really big issue, working through our alumni pool, talking to community members, and that's what our community gets. The UW-Milwaukee community really understands exactly how lean we are, and they've done their part to support it as much as our community can. But unfortunately, it's not quite enough right now, and we're working to make that pool a little bit larger.
Now, in a lot of college towns around the state, the UW campus, whichever one you're talking about, is the big game in town, sometimes the only game in town. In Milwaukee, you've got Marquette there, too. It gets a lot of attention in the state and nationally. Are these budget cuts going to hurt UW-Milwaukee's efforts to stand out in the city with such a major colleague down the street?
I have a lot of good friends at Marquette. They do good things at the institution, but I'm very confident that UW-Milwaukee will continue to be a shining star in our state and in the rest of the country when they look at their college experience. An example of this, our enrollment actually has gone up 6% from last year. So students still understand that UW-Milwaukee is making huge strides. The last decade, we've really grown and come into our own in terms of research and student experience as well as student success after graduation. We're looking to expand internships, co-ops, and other programs at our school. Our undergraduate research program is perhaps the most vibrant in the entire state. I'm not worried at all that UW-Milwaukee will continue to shine, to be a shining star in the state. We just hope that we can get the funding to do so to an even greater degree in the future.
And what was, getting back to that UW Regents meeting today, what was the atmosphere like? Just give us that firsthand experience.
Sure. So the atmosphere, the room was in general filled with a good number of students today. A lot of the student body presidents and vice presidents showed up today to help support students in the room. And then there were also administration and faculty and staff there as well. But the general feel of the room was, you know, it's a bit sad, but it's been a few months since the first announcement in February and since the subsequent follow-up on the May 29th omnibus amendment that the Joint Finance Committee put forth. And we're ready to move on. We're so heartbroken. It's still on our minds every morning we wake up, every time we go to bed at night. But we're ready to move forward as a system. We're ready to grow past this.
And, Mike, before I let you go, can you just make the case for the value of UW-Milwaukee for the city, the region, and the state as a whole?
Absolutely. UW-Milwaukee is an essential cornerstone to the Milwaukee community. There's a reason why we have so many up and growing companies in Milwaukee that we have partnerships with all over. Our undergraduate research, as I spoke a little bit earlier to, is perhaps the most vibrant in the system. We have tons of people taking advantage of that opportunity. Our Student Success Center at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is also perhaps one of the most successful. We take student success very seriously here, and we provide a lot of great academic, social, and other volunteer opportunities. We were just named a Carnegie Award, which is recognizing community service. And we're happy to say that we're unsurprised by this recognition. UW-Milwaukee cares for its community, and its community cares for us.
Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Mike Sportello, student body president at UW-Milwaukee, with us to talk about the UW system budget cuts and how they'll percolate to the different campuses around the state, UW-Milwaukee in particular. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about a Wisconsin senator's call to make community college free in the United States. First, Wisconsin, known as America's Dairyland, but that title may come with a price. According to a recent report from the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, Kewaunee County, which houses more than 70,000 cattle, had a number of tested drinking wells containing nitrates or coliform bacteria levels because of animal waste. The report places most of the blame on large farming operations, often called CAFOs, which have grown rapidly over the past decades. We're joined now by Scott Dye, a field coordinator with the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, for more on that report. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So, Scott, what brought your group's attention to Kewaunee County in Wisconsin?
Well, Kewaunee County, it has severe drinking water problems. It also has the largest cattle density of any county in Wisconsin. It's number one in density of concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, 15 large industrial dairies and one large-scale beef operation, and it ranks number two in permitted CAFOs. What brought our concern to it was the residents of the county contacting us to let us know that 30% at least of the wells that have been tested, and in some townships in the county, up to 55% of the wells that have been tested have found to be unsafe levels of nitrates and E. coli bacteria. And it has rendered their drinking water, which 95% of the county draws their drinking water from shallow aquifers, unfit to drink. And by unfit to drink, that means you can't drink it, you can't wash your hands with it, you can't wash your dishes, you can't shower in it. What we're really talking about here is third world conditions right in America's heartland.
Now, the authors of an op-ed in the Green Bay Press Gazette, in response to your report, authors affiliated with the industry said, hey, this wasn't a random sampling of wells. These are voluntary tests over a 10-year period. The statistics, they say, that you said are overstating the problem with drinking water with wells in the county. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would just ask folks to do their own research and check for themselves. Talk to the people that live in Kewaunee County. This is a extremely difficult problem for the people that are literally found their water to be unusable. We really, until that happens to you, we really don't realize what a hardship that actually is on people to not be able to use their drinking water. So, and this report was based on over a year's worth of research. We spent literally around 20 days in Wisconsin DNR offices going through over 6,000 pages of documents, another 1,000 pages of federal documents, over 2,000 emails to put this report together. So we're very confident in what the conclusions of the report draws.
So draw the line from these large operations with lots of cattle to the wells, to the drinking water in the county.
Well, as you had stated, there's been a real explosion in the number of large-scale or industrial-sized dairy farms in Wisconsin over the last, especially the last decade. We're talking about operations that are 5,000, in some cases more, cows confined in one location. These are not your grandfather's dairy farms or either your father's dairy farms. And what we found is pretty much a complete disregard for state and federal clean water laws by the operators that run these operations. It simply is a matter of a concentration of way too much animal waste in one location. In Kewaunee County, for instance, there are approximately 80,000 cows, four cows for every man, woman, and child in the county. It's a matter of too much waste in one place. That's exacerbated by DNR is responsible for protecting public health and the environment. And quite frankly, the cop is just not on the beat. That said, they are underfunded, they are understaffed, and right now they are politically hamstrung by the state's current administration. Governor Walker seems to be very intent on gutting the ability of the agency to do its job to protect public health and the environment.
So if the DNR investigated and found code violations at one of these CAFOs, these large dairy or cattle operations, what are the punishments for mismanagement of manure on one of these operations?
Almost nothing. They have a tiered enforcement system where you're given a notice of noncompliance, a notice of deficiency, or a notice of violation. Any of those could result in what they refer to as an enforcement conference. That is a sit-down between the agency and the operators. They say, please don't do that anymore. The operators say, we won't do that anymore. And almost never are fines or penalties actually levied. And then the operators go back to doing the same general disregard for their neighbors' concerns and for the law.
As you see it from the research you've done, is there a way to handle manure from one of these CAFOs, these large animal feeding operations, to manage that manure in a sustainable way that won't affect the environment negatively? Or is it impossible, regardless of whatever laws we have on the books, for one of these operations to properly deal with manure?
In our opinion, I believe it is. When you're talking about this scale of volume, and we're talking in Kewaunee County, 340 million gallons of untreated liquefied manure, plus 81,000 tons at least of solid manure, all placed on the land under the guise that it's being used as fertilizer. The problem really comes in when you liquefy animal waste. Certainly animal waste is one of the greatest fertilizers for soil tilth, for soil health, for good crop production out there. However, when you liquefy it, it becomes extremely mobile in the environment. And that's a real contributing factor is the location of Kewaunee County. It sits on what is called karst geography. And karst geography is essentially, the best way to think of it is Swiss cheese. The bedrock is very shallow. Many places in the county, it's less than 2 feet. So what is poured on top of the soil quickly migrates down into the very shallow aquifer where, again, 95% of the citizens in that county are drawing their drinking water. So when you get into a liquid waste handling system, it's almost impossible to operate these things at this level of scale without doing environmental damage.
Talking to Scott Dye with the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, looking at a report his organization did on animal operations, CAFOs, they're often called in Kewaunee County, and their connection to water quality problems in that county. Now, you've mentioned, Scott, you don't see the DNR doing its job here. Some residents, your report actually says some residents have appealed to the Environmental Protection Agency to provide clean drinking water. What has the EPA done in response? What could they do?
Certainly what they have not yet formally responded. It's a Safe Drinking Water Act emergency petition authorized by the Clean Water Act. As of yet, federal EPA has not responded. It usually takes them a few months to respond. If they do respond positively, which we believe that they will go about trying to identify the source of the contamination, whether it be spills, leaking lagoons, overapplication of waste where it runs off into streams, rivers, wetlands, Lake Michigan itself. And then they would also try to find ways to compel the operators to provide safe drinking water for those whose wells have been impacted.
So can you share some of the stories you've heard from residents of Kewaunee County about their water, what they're having to do?
Well, I think one of the most heart-wrenching ones that I heard was a grandmother up there who every afternoon she watches her grandchildren until their parents can pick them up later in the afternoon. Her granddaughter was outside playing. She got a cut on her finger. She instinctively went in and washed off the cut in the sink with the tap water coming out of their polluted well. And that grandmother could not sleep that night, terrified that she may have to take her daughter into the emergency room for E. coli poisoning. So it's a very, very heart-wrenching stories from the people that have to live in these conditions. And again, I would refer to these as third-world conditions.
Is it possible to treat these wells that are showing signs of contamination to decontaminate them?
What the DNR suggests, if you have a contaminated well, is to pour bleach into it. And that does remediate some of the concerns with E. coli bacteria. Not nearly so much with nitrates, which can cause blue baby syndrome, abortions in cattle if the cattle are drinking it. It just doesn't sound like a very tenable solution to continue pouring bleach in your water to try to make it drinkable.
Now, we've got a growing world population, a growing demand for beef and dairy in the United States and around the world. It might be tough, some people are saying, to keep up with that demand without these large-scale factory-sized operations. Can we meet our food needs if we don't have these CAFOs and maybe more of them in the near future?
Well, I think the easy answer to that, Rob, is just to simply look back 10 years ago before this huge proliferation of these industrial-scale farms. We were feeding this country just fine with America's family farmers for the last 2.5 centuries. So we were doing a fine job feeding America with good, safe, wholesome food. Really what this is being driven by is exports, and that is feeding the world by exporting a lot of this product, meats, cheese, dairy, to other countries. However, that's a bit of a red herring, because we're not exporting to, I guess I would say you're not going to see starving children in Africa eating pork chops and eating brie cheese. We're exporting to countries that have the money to buy our agricultural exports. So that's it's really a false argument.
So apart from DNR or maybe EPA action, are you hoping to see some kind of cap in law limiting the density of animals on these operations?
Yes, and I think it's very important to note that the residents up here, they understand that Wisconsin has every right to be very proud of the fact that it is America's Dairyland. It's right on the plates. Something that the local residents frequently say is they're not trying to shut these operations down. They just simply want them to be good neighbors and to not have such horrific impacts on their lives and on their families. And a phrase that they use constantly is, we are full. We're not trying to shut them down. What we're trying to get them to do is comply with the laws that are on the books that their permits require, and to be good neighbors. And that is the real problem here, is they simply have no good neighbor policy when operations become of this size and scale.
Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
That was Scott Dye. He's a field coordinator with the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project, talking about Kewaunee County's water quality issues and large animal farming operations. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up later, the state budget is heading to Governor Walker's desk. We'll take a look at some possible line item vetoes that might be in the works. First, Democrats in Congress, including Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, introduced legislation this week that would make community college free, potentially for millions of students. It's an extension of the plan that President Obama talked about earlier this year in his State of the Union address, and again last week during his visit to La Crosse. While Baldwin's bill might not gain any traction in a Republican-controlled Congress, our next guest says the concept of free community college is gaining momentum. Some states are taking charge. Paul Fain is with us now. He's news editor at Inside Higher Ed. Paul, good to have you back with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with this federal legislation introduced by Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin and Virginia's Bobby Scott. What are they proposing here?
Well, this very closely mirrors what President Obama unveiled earlier this year in January, his America's College Promise, which would seek to make 2 years of community college essentially free, tuition-free, for all qualifying students. There are some eligibility requirements, like a 2.5 GPA, but this would be a large federal subsidy to states that would participate. Basically, the federal government would kick in $3 for every dollar that states would throw in to cover the total cost of attending community college.
Now, as I understand it, this may go a little further than what President Obama had proposed. Are there differences between those two ideas or plans?
Well, I mean, the biggest difference is the budget proposal. The president had said $60 billion over 10, so about $6 billion a year. This would be $90 billion. And there are some additional funding proposals. Some of them include $10 billion for some additional funding for historically black colleges and other minority-serving institutions for the first 2 years of college that students attend there. And again, this money is really aimed at wiping out the tuition costs.
And how many students, if this thing came into place, and we'll get into whether that's likely in a bit, but about how many students across the country could potentially take advantage of this program?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the exact estimate of how many might benefit, but if they were successful for the $90 billion, it'd be quite a few. I mean, just the – I know that they did predict or estimate that the minority-serving institutions would be 300,000, and it would be far more for the community colleges.
And how big a role do the colleges we're talking about here, the community colleges and the others affected in this legislation, how big a part of the picture of higher education in this country are those schools?
Well, community college students are 45% roughly of the undergraduate population, so really about half. I mean, if you take California alone, it enrolls 2.1 million community college students, so really a huge part of American higher education, and one, frankly, it's often overlooked, and despite your politics, you have to say that the president has done quite a bit to elevate community college students in the discussions about higher education.
And what's been the sales pitch as to the benefits of doing something like this from the president, from the people in Congress sponsoring this?
Well, I think first and foremost, there is a growing belief, and research backs this up, that some college is really a requirement to get into the workforce. For folks to get a good paying job, these days you really do need some college. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but that can be a one-year certificate, a technical certificate, getting into a dental assistant job, on up to an associate degree and beyond. But I think the idea is really to help students access higher education. And, while it might not seem like a lot of money to wealthier people, wiping out the $4,000 or $5,000 a year that it costs at a lot of places to attend community college would make a real difference so that folks can believe that college is for them, too.
Talking to Paul Fain from Inside Higher Ed about a plan co-sponsored by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin to make community college free for eligible students. So it's got a price tag. The Republican-led Congress might not buy into it. Do you have any reason to think that this could pass Congress as currently constituted?
I'm not one to speculate usually, but on this one I will take a big risk and say no. Really no chance right now. As folks know, the Republicans control both chambers of our U.S. Congress, and while these bills in the Senate and House had quite a few Democratic co-sponsors, they had no support from Republicans at all.
What has the negative reaction sounded like to this proposal, whether from the president or from lawmakers? Is it mostly about the cost?
On the bills this week, it's been pretty quiet. But when the president first rolled this idea out, you had quite a few Republicans who said that they, too, support community college students and helping them access higher education, but that some of them said a better way to do that might be for states to take the lead and finding their own solutions to helping these students have a more affordable pathway. I have heard some say a better way to do it would be targeted federal financial aid, such as through increasing Pell Grants. But to be honest, Republicans have not been big champions for increasing those spending levels.
Well, you mentioned the states, and let's go there next. Tennessee has been noted, and President Obama recognized Tennessee as one of the first to do something like this. Can you tell us what they've done there?
Yeah, Tennessee is the first state to really go big on a free community college proposal, and actually they were quite influential in what the president ended up doing. And interestingly, there's a Republican governor there, Bill Haslam, who really was a lead role in making that happen. So there is some bipartisan interest in this. Tennessee, the really interesting thing is they found the money. They were able to use a lottery endowment, about 300-some million, set it aside and created a evergreen pot of money to fund this scholarship for tuition-free community college. Their first-year cost, they estimated about $34 million, and the idea is that even if Bill Haslam moves on at some point, that money will still be there. And, this plan, there's a lot of complexity here, but it also, in Tennessee, requires some eligibility requirements. Students have to maintain a GPA level. They also have to do some community service. But basically, the way that plan it works is all other aid goes first. So a student goes to a community college, they apply for state and federal financial aid, and whatever gap is there, this scholarship fills in the gap.
And now Oregon, the legislature there has passed a similar legislation or a free community college plan. I believe it's still waiting for the governor to sign it. What does the Oregon promise, they're calling it, look like?
It's pretty interesting. They, like most states, did not find as much money as Tennessee. There's a lot of interest in states about these sort of ideas when it comes time to pay for them, much like the federal government. It gets a little less exciting. But what they did do, they set aside $10 million a year. It's capped at a scholarship for students to attend community college. Even the creators of this bill say that won't cover all students. But they added a couple really interesting features to the bill, which I had not heard others propose before. One is that even if students have federal and state aid that cover their entire costs or tuition costs, they still get a $1,000 minimum grant from the state. And that's really important to a lot of people who say, you know, tuition isn't the whole problem. Even community college students, there are quite a few additional costs like books, transportation. I actually looked this up, Madison Area Technical College, that the estimated total cost of attendance is $10,000 a year. So this $1,000 will go to students who can use that even beyond their federal and state aid.
So not just the tuition cost, that is the price tag we think of at first.
Correct, yeah. And there is research out there that shows that even something like a $1,000 grant can really help students. You know, a lot of community college students have to leave when life intervenes, as folks say in higher ed. It means, you know, they could literally just have a hard time paying the bills 1 month and have to leave college. And if you have a grant that the state is funding for $1,000, that could really help people get past those tough moments.
So that's Tennessee, Oregon. Have other states started to kick this idea around?
Yeah, there's been some discussions. Mississippi, I guess it was about 2 years ago, looked at it, didn't have the money, didn't go through with it. It's not a state, but since I live there, you know, I like to think of it as being part of the United States. The Washington, D.C. City Council is looking at doing this, and that looks somewhat promising. I have a feeling there will be others. Minnesota actually has a pilot. They did do some free community college plan for their technical colleges. So this is really bubbling up, and it's not just states. Cities are doing it as well.
We're talking right now with Paul Fain from Inside Higher Ed about efforts around the country to make community college free for eligible students. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin introduced federal legislation this week that would do just that. Some states have kicked it off as well. What do you think? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does the idea of free community college sound like a good idea to you? Is this something you'd take advantage of yourself or maybe encourage your kids to take part in? Or do you have concerns about the plan and maybe what it would cost? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in a moment, maybe hear from you. First, a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about proposals to make community college free. It's an idea championed by President Obama, being pursued in legislation this week, co-sponsored by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin, and it's come up in a couple of states and others are considering it. We want to know what you think about the idea now at 800-642-1234. Should the federal government and or the state government be in the business of paying for community college or helping pay for more of it? What would you see as the benefits? What would you see as the drawbacks, the problems? And what questions do you have about how all of this works? And are you a community college student, a graduate? Were you in a situation where there was a tight margin? It would have been really easy for even a small financial problem to knock you out of community college. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul Fain stays with us. He's with Inside Higher Ed. And Paul, a quote from a Senator Mark Hess, state senator in Oregon, who says, a lifetime of food stamps is much more expensive than the annual community college tuition of $3,000. So do we know, is there a payoff for community college attendance? Does it lead to better financial, economic outcomes in the long term for students who complete it?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say to not believe the hype out there that questions whether college is worth it. There is reams of evidence that attending college is the best way to ensure that you will have a career, and that includes community college. Community college is a great on-ramp to many jobs. And, you know, the state senator in Oregon raised the point that, you know, there's a real appeal to this for lawmakers in that in Oregon there are 70,000 young folks who don't have a higher education and don't have a job, and instead of the state paying to try to support those folks, how about helping them get a job? And that appeal, I think, extends to some Republicans like the governor of Tennessee.
Now, would this have an effect on enrollment in traditional colleges where there are obviously financial issues, concerns over student debt? Would this be just taking some people out of the more expensive schools and moving them to community college?
Great question, one that's hotly debated in higher education, and since all of this is pretty new, the results are not in. There are two thoughts here. One is that it seems possible that some students might elect to go to two-year college instead of four-year college, and some of the four-year universities are concerned about that, concerned about losing some of their enrollment pipeline. However, others say, fully a third of students transfer and during their college career. That's a nationwide number. And there's a lot of community college students who go on to four-year colleges. So if you increase the overall student attendance pipeline, you're going to have more academically prepared students transferring in from community college to those universities. So it's still up for debate.
Now, the White House has said it wants to encourage a shift in the way lawmakers, business leaders, the public view community college. You said earlier that President Obama has really been trying to put community college on the map. Do we as a culture tend to look down on community college when we think about it at all?
You know, I do think at least in the media or policymakers, those folks, most of us, attended a four-year university, and I think are a little out of sync with reality. You know, when 45% of people are going to community colleges, these are good institutions that a lot of folks depend on to get good jobs. And, you know, frankly, I think that's changing. I think the discourse over higher education is getting more sophisticated. You see a little bit less of the complaining about $50,000 tuition at a private college because, frankly, it's a small slice of America that's even weighing that option.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Adam on the line in Platteville. Adam, hi.
Hello. My big thing is I've gone to technical colleges before, and they seem to kind of have the eye on the prize a little bit better than, say, a four-year college in general. Because they focus on, okay, you spent your last 12 years in grade school and high school learning how to be a well-rounded individual, learning the stuff that makes the world go round. And when you get to college and you go to a four-year college, you get forced into taking, you know, 1 to 2 years worth of gen eds that don't really pertain to what your college career is. So you spend time and money doing something that doesn't really benefit your career on what you want to do, whether it be becoming an engineer. Engineers don't need psychology classes, especially when they're a civil engineer or an electrical engineer. They need engineering classes and math classes. Why are we making education bigger than what's necessary or not specializing them more and making it 3 years, giving them more information to make them even better engineers and not waste time on the stuff that doesn't really pertain to their career goals or their job goals?
Adam, thanks a lot for that call. And Paul, I imagine this is an issue that's been debated a lot in higher education circles too, but a selling point, Adam is saying, for technical colleges, community colleges, that if you want the job focused, the outcome focused experience, this is a good way to get it.
Yeah, you know, just to respond, it's a great question, and as you say, one that comes up a lot. I will say, looking at what employers want, and let's use engineering firms, they say they need more engineers who can do writing, who can do public speaking, who can do critical thinking, and those are exactly what good general education programs teach students. A well-rounded four-year degree path is going to teach an engineer how to do a lot more than just technical engineering. You know, because frankly, if you're an engineer, you're learning all the time on the job. The technical piece, frankly, you're going to get a lot on the job, but learning to write is something that I think employers really look to colleges to do. That said, community colleges are very, very good at being tied directly to employers, employer needs. They know what the jobs are. They speak with employers, and they retool their curriculums so that they're training workers for those jobs.
Thanks a lot for the call, Adam. We're talking to Paul Fain from Inside Higher Ed about efforts at the federal level and some state levels to provide free community college to eligible students. Back to our callers now with Bruce in Partyville. Bruce, hi.
I've actually worked in the student loan industry for almost 17 years now. I think this is a step towards changing what I call the conversation. For years, starting at the high school level, we essentially told kids that if they borrowed enough money, they could attend the finest institutions in this country. The conversation really needs to be, can you afford to graduate from that institution, not can you afford to get to it? And using community college as a way to either better prepare kids for the larger institution, to make them college ready, or to simply decrease the cost of the total education, it's a step in the right direction. But we really need to change the conversation and start looking at, can I graduate from an institution, not can I afford to get there?
Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. Paul, a good stepping stone here, but a wider conversation needed. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's happening. I think the federal government, not trying to give too much credit to the Obama administration here, but they have tried to get more consumer information out there, and there's bipartisan support for that, so that students know what they're getting into. You really need to be an informed consumer when you're weighing your options for higher education. And I agree. I think there's a lot of agreement that taking on too much debt is not a good idea. So I think students need to be wary of doing that. And community college is definitely a good option to avoid some of the really deep debt traps that can be a lifelong problem.
Bruce, thanks for the call. We've got Nathan in Waukesha on the line now. Nathan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I see the benefits of community college and agree that enrollment should be increased, and especially that there's too much focus on four-year colleges and liberal arts degrees and all that. But my fear with free college is it hides the cost of increasing education, since it becomes a government budget thing and not an out-of-pocket thing. And plus it helps the students, I think, to have some skin in the game. And maybe if it's not free, it could be like greatly reduced in cost.
Nathan, thanks for the call. So if it's completely free, maybe the student won't take it as seriously. Do you think there's something there, Paul?
I do. You've got some good questions today. That is one of the toughest ones of all for this. There is an argument, and I think it's really proving true, in Tennessee at least, that if you say community college is free, at least tuition free, it really opens the doors to students who don't believe that college is for them. A lot of first-generation, low-income students who don't have college-educated parents at home helping them are realizing that you can go to college thanks to the free. Everybody loves free. So 90% of Tennessee's high school graduates this year applied for their free tuition program. However, there are quite a few folks who are concerned about the idea of moving from public education being K through 12 to K through 14. And frankly, I do think it's fair to worry about that, because I think some of what the Obama administration is trying to do is to encourage 2 years of community college to be part of a public right. And that's a very big difference from the way we look at higher education right now.
Well, a federal change, as we wrap up, Paul, seems like it's a ways off. Do you expect to see a lot more dominoes to fall on this effort at the state or maybe even big city level?
I do. I think presidential candidates are talking about debt-free and tuition-free college every day, and we're 440 days away from a presidential election. And I'm seeing a lot of interest in the states and its cities, and frankly, even at community colleges themselves, trying to look at programs like this. Tulsa Community College has been doing a tuition-free program for about 8 years. So from at least the 1,000 points of light perspective, I think you're going to see a lot of experimentation around the country.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Paul Fain. He is news editor for Inside Higher Ed. He joined us to talk about a federal proposal for a free 2-year community college in the United States, as well as what states like Tennessee and Oregon have been doing on that effort.